The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're taking a look at one of the most fascinating and coveted substances in nature. And it's probably lurking in the corners of your attic. We're joined by Leslie Brunetta, co-author of the book Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating. But first, let's find out about some researchers that are working on a unique way to produce this natural wonder material in the lab. I'm here with Ed Young. Ed is an award-winning science writer whose work has appeared in publications like New Scientist, Nature, The Guardian, Wired UK, the BBC, and CNN. He's also the author of the blog Not Exactly Rocket Science, which is hosted by Discover Magazine. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Hi.
Now, just so we're not burying the lead here, you wrote a post about this and the title sums it up nicely. Genetically engineered silkworms with spider genes spin super strong silk. How'd they do that?
So this is the latest in what has been a really long quest to make artificial spider silk. This was a deceptively simple study in its concept, because it takes silkworms, a creature that naturally spins silk, and uses them to create silk that's a sort of composite material between what they normally spin and what a spider would normally spin. So the scientists behind it took the genes from an orb-webbed spider and shunted them into the silk-making glands of a silkworm. And lo and behold, the worms actually produced a silk that was sort of partly their own and partly a spider's.
So in fact, the silk that they're spinning only contains a small fraction of spider silk proteins then?
That's right. It's a tiny proportion. It's just about 2-5%. What was really surprising about the study, I think, is that despite only containing this small proportion of spider silk, this composite material had much, much better properties than normal silkworm silk. It was much tougher. It was much stronger. It was more elastic. It wasn't quite as good as normal spider silk, but you wouldn't expect it to be. It was still probably better than one would have hoped for.
Now, the gene splicing technique that they used is really fascinating. Tell us about piggyback.
Piggyback was identified in the 1980s by Malcolm Fraser, who was one of the scientists behind this study. It's one of a number of different genes or pieces of DNA that can hop around the genome. So it can cut itself out of one bit and paste itself into another bit. And Fraser has since worked out ways of turning piggyback into a vehicle for other genes. So if you put a gene of your choice into this mobile piece of DNA, it can also then hop around from one part of the genome to another. So you can use piggyback as a sort of shuttle for introducing genes into places where they normally wouldn't be. So in this case, spider genes into the silk glands of a silkworm.
And this isn't the first time that scientists have tried to make spider silk in the lab.
No, it's been this really ongoing process. It's been a very long and difficult quest because spider silk is a very complicated material. It's not just the proteins. It's the fact that the proteins are woven into this quite intricate fiber. So scientists have managed to recreate spider silk proteins in the lab before in a number of different laboratory organisms. But actually turning that into a proper fiber with all its wonderful properties is a much, much more difficult thing to do. And this study, I think, is a very interesting step towards that, because obviously silkworms make their own fibers naturally, so they're well placed to take the spider genes and turn them into an actually useful product.
Can you tell us about some of the other ways that we've tried to do this in the past?
We've tried to put the genes for spider silk proteins into bacteria, into plants like tobacco and potatoes. You can make a fair amount of these proteins, but actually scaling that up is very difficult, and turning them into fibers, as I said, is very difficult. It seems bizarre, really, to think that no one had thought of using silkworms before, but silkworms aren't really a standard tool for genetic engineers. They're not an animal that's frequently used in that respect.
So what's the next step for these researchers?
So the next step is pretty clear, really. It's to try and get the silkworms to spin silk that is entirely spider silk. So you need to somehow knock out their own ability to make their own silkworm silk so that they're only using the spider genes that they've got. And that way you could get a material that's 100% spider silk rather than this composite, which will hopefully have all the strength and toughness and elasticity of natural spider silk.
What about spider silk makes it so attractive that we would go to this much trouble to synthesize it?
It's a truly wonderful material. I mean, if you think about what spider silk actually has to do in the wild, these orb web spiders are trapping insects that are flying at really high speed. So this insect careens into the web, and the web's got to absorb all the energy from its flight, ping back to its original shape without breaking or fracturing or deforming. So it's incredibly strong. It's incredibly tough. I mean, people say that it's strong. Spider silk can be stronger than steel, tougher than Kevlar. The tougher silk that we know of is woven by a type of spider called the Darwin's bark spider, whose web is so big that it can span entire rivers. And this is just it's the toughest biomaterial that's ever been discovered. That's how tough it is. So it's got spider silk has these wonderful properties, which makes it really interesting for say creating body armor or even for medical reasons. You know, you could create prosthetics or implants. You can use them for sutures, and obviously because they're biological, they might be less likely to induce a nasty immune reaction, for example.
I think what's most interesting to me is just that we put all of this technological effort into trying to recreate something that spiders produce naturally.
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, you know, you could think about maybe farming spiders in order to extract enough silk, but that's really difficult because spiders don't actually make that much silk. So actually trying to extract enough is very hard. Also, spiders are very territorial and they sometimes eat each other. So actually getting them in large enough quantities to extract enough is really hard. And, you know, one of the things I wrote out in the post is this wonderful story about these people who took 82 years, 82 people, 4 years and 1 million spiders to make a piece of cloth that measures just 11 by 4 feet. So, you know, this isn't something that you can mass produce. But silkworms, on the other hand, have been domesticated for centuries. They are very easy to grow in very large numbers. And we have all that sort of infrastructure in place for cultivating large numbers of silkworms. So that's, you know, that's certainly one bonus. If you think about the need to scale up this technology once you've really got it, well, that scaling up has already happened.
Well, thanks very much for being here, Ed.
That's okay. Pleasure.
And we'll be right back to talk with Leslie Brunetta, co-author of Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Leslie Brunetta, freelance journalist with an arts degree from Princeton and a master's of philosophy from St. Catherine's College, Oxford. She's the co-author of Spider Silk, evolution and 400 million years of spinning, waiting, snagging, and mating. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Leslie.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
So you and arachnologist Catherine Craig decided to write this book in part because spider silk is phenomenally interesting, but also because it happens to be a brilliant way to explain some of the misconceptions around natural selection, correct?
Well, the story is Kay was an arachnologist for quite a long time. She was a leading arachnologist, and she wrote a monograph. This brilliant monograph mainly for other arachnologists and people with a technical interest in evolution. And she had asked me, we had met, and she had asked me to do some minor editing on it. And while I was reading it, I realized that although I thought I understood how evolution worked, I really didn't, and that I had these, I think, fairly common misconceptions. And some of those misconceptions were things that they don't really bear examination when you think about them. It's just that most of us non-biologists don't really think about them.
Right.
So what I realized was that spiders are very unusual in that when people write about evolution for non-biologists, they often will write about different concepts in evolution, and in order to best demonstrate those concepts, they'll jump from animal to animal or plant or organism or whatever. And then, or they'll write about an animal or an organism that they think people will be really, really interested in, like humans, for instance. And the thing is that there's just a huge amount of human evolution that we really don't know anything about. The thing that struck me about spiders was they rely incredibly heavily on their silks. Their silks are proteins. You can then trace proteins right back to genes. There's a body now of research on spider silk genes and spider silk proteins that started building in the 1990s. And then there's also a pretty good fossil record that goes back close to 400 million years. So what that meant was that by looking at specifically at the evolution of spider silks, you know, not just the evolution of spiders, we could, you know, tell a chronological story that covered, you know, a period, just unbelievable changes in life on land. You could see how spiders used silk to adapt to many of those changes. And at the same time, you could look at these silks because, and the most important thing is that different silks evolved over time, and there's now good evidence for when they evolved, and go back to the genes. So I think that for most non-biologists, it's very, very difficult to understand how, you know, small genetic changes could possibly lead to adaptations that, you know, can really make an organism able to live in an environment. So that's the most basic reason why we did that, why we wrote the book.
Well, let's talk about the earliest spider ancestors, the arthropods. So what were they like 450 million years ago?
Well, arthropods are the biggest phylum in the animal kingdom. So before animals came up on land, there were arthropods really teeming in the seas and oceans. Arthropods are, you know, spiders are arthropods, insects are arthropods, lobsters and crabs are arthropods. Arthropods are the animals that have segmented bodies, they have jointed legs, and they have an exoskeleton. The exoskeleton is like, you know, the lobster shell. So in a small insect or a small spider, that exoskeleton is in miniature. It turns out that arthropods appear to be some of the very earliest animals to come up on land. And a lot of that has to do, and this is according to the fossil record, a lot of that has to do with the fact that their exoskeleton protected them from drying out and from the sun, and it also allowed them to support their weight in a way that something like, I don't know what, you know, a sponge or something mm-hmm. would not be able to do. The earliest spider-related fossil that anybody has found yet is Attercopus. It may be Attercopus. I just want to say up front that for all you arachnologists or arachnologists out there, my pronunciation is fairly dodgy. And so I'll just say that up front.
We will both mangle all of these words continually, and I will receive emails about it. So do continue.
Okay. So Attercopus, when they found the Attercopus fossil, at first they thought it was a spider. And Attercopus fossil is about 380 million years old. The reason they thought it was a spider was they found what looked like a spinneret. And a spinneret is the exterior part of the spider's silk-making system. They're found on the abdomen of the spiders, and only spiders have abdominal spinnerets. And if it doesn't have an abdominal spinneret, it's not a spider. So they found legs that clearly looked like spider legs, and they found this spinneret. So they thought, and they announced, even in published papers, that this was the oldest spider fossil. It later turned out that spinneret was not actually a spinneret, although it did have silk spigots on it. It's kind of a long story. We tell the story in the book, but it was a silk-producing animal. It was producing silk from its abdomen, and it either was a direct ancestor of the spiders or very, very closely related to the direct ancestor of the spiders.
Well, actually, what I'm wondering about is sort of when the first silk-spinning spider fossils date to.
So that Attercopus was spinning silk. It was producing silk. The interesting thing was it didn't have spinnerets.
Right.
The first fossil that we have that is absolutely positively a spider is a mesothel fossil that's about 290 million years old. So, you know, we're talking about spiders or their direct ancestors spinning silk for close to 400 million years.
Well, actually, you mentioned something in the book, the difficulty in researching these spider fossils in the first place.
They're tiny.
Right.
Most of them. And the way that arthropods fossilize, I mean, we're kind of lucky any of them fossilize. The soft tissue that's inside the exoskeleton doesn't fossilize. So you're relying on this very, very thin layer of exoskeleton to become fossilized. And it's usually, you know, squashed or mangled or torn apart. So it's a real real expertise is used to figure out these fossils.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about the book Spider Silk: Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating. My guest is the co-author Leslie Brunetta. So, how did the capacity to spin silk evolve?
Well, the interesting thing is that silk is actually, although spider silk is an unusual substance, silk itself is actually a fairly common substance. I mean, many different types of insect makes silk, as do other kinds of arthropods. I mean, bees, for instance, make a kind of silk that they use to reinforce their that kind of paper stuff that they make in their hives. Flea larvae make silk to protect themselves like little cocoons. Silkworms obviously make silk. So the ability to produce silk fibers seems to have evolved multiple times in multiple different branches of the whole evolutionary tree. With spiders, what's interesting is that the earliest evolved spiders basically make more or less one kind of silk. Although they make a number of different kinds of silk proteins, they make more or less one kind of silk that they use indiscriminately. And when you get to the later evolved spiders, who are the ones that most of us are familiar with, you know, the ones like that make the orb webs like Charlotte's web or cobweb spiders or jumping spiders or any spider that you see hanging on a thread. What's interesting then is they've evolved the ability to make multiple types of silk, and each of those silks has different properties, and each is used for a different function.
I guess the most important animal to look at when you're actually studying the production of silk is the mesotheles. And you say that the reason for that is that they're a living fossil.
Yeah, they're, I would love to see one. I've never seen one of these in real life. They only live in Asia. They've barely changed since this 290 million year old fossil. They're called mesotheles because meso means middle and thele means teat, because their spinnerets look like teats and they're in the middle of the underneath of their abdomen. Whereas later spiders, spiders that evolved later have their spinnerets at the ends of their abdomen. And the thing that I find fascinating about these spiders is that they live as though the Earth really hadn't changed since they first evolved. I mean, when spiders first evolved, plants were, you know, maybe a few inches tall. There weren't birds, there weren't wasps, there weren't mammals, there weren't reptiles roaming around. But it was still a very dangerous world because you had all these various other arthropods, millipedes and sow bugs and, well, sow bugs are not predators, but you had various predatory arthropods, including other spiders, because the thing about spiders is, you know, spiders will even eat their brothers and sisters.
Right.
It was really a quite dangerous place. Plus, you had the sun beating down because you didn't have shade because plants were so small. So mesotheles live by digging a burrow, and then they line that burrow with silk, and then they use their spinnerets, which are fairly flexible. They're quite dexterous, really. They use silk to construct a flap trap door that they can pull shut in the burrow, and they hide out in this burrow. So it's mainly to protect. So silk seems to have first evolved probably not as a way to catch insects, which is the way most of us think of spider silk being used. It probably evolved first as a way to protect spiders' eggs and then to protect the spider itself, because by lining the burrow in that way, it not only shores up the walls of the burrow, makes the burrow stronger, it also controls to a certain extent the humidity within the burrow and a little bit the temperature, more the humidity within the burrow. And the flap door, the trap door, protects the mesothelial spider from its enemies. So when it does want to catch food, what it does is it sticks its legs out of the door of the burrow, has them out there, and each one of those is like a sensor. Some of these spiders, but not all of them, some of them spin little threads, lines, away from the entrance of the burrow. So if anything goes by, they're like trip lines. If anything goes by there, the spider feels those and then just lunges out, grabs the prey, and drags it back into the burrow.
We have a question from Kristen.
Are there any spiders that don't spin silk at all?
As far as anyone knows, there are no spiders who don't spin any silk at all. There are spiders who don't make webs, but they use their silk for other reasons. They either use it, as I said, with the mesotheles to line their burrow, or, you know, jumping spiders. Most jumping spiders do not spin any kind of web, but they rely very, very heavily on silk. Mainly in their drag line, which is the safety line that they use. That's what allows them to jump, because if they miss, they have this safety line that holds them. And then, of course, they'll also use silk for their egg cases. Male spiders, spider sex is quite odd.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it is.
So male spiders use silk to create something called a sperm web, which is when spiders copulate, they do not do so directly for reasons that no one understands yet. They've evolved this way of doing things, which is the male spider builds this little ribbon of silk, which is called a sperm web. He then goes upside down under it, deposits sperm on that silk. Then he's got these little kind of small, they're not legs, but they're like modified legs up near his head called pedipalps. Females have them too, but for males, there's a modified foot on the end that's kind of like a bulb. He draws the sperm off that sperm web into the palpal organs, they're called, and then goes looking for a female. And what he, and so then the way that they mate is he then inserts those into the copulatory organs in the female. So it's an unusual way of going
and,
about
and
things.
What evolutionary advantage would that provide? Just wondering.
That's one of the great mysteries of spider evolution. People would really like to be able to figure out how that evolved, but that will be a very hard one to figure out.
Well, let's talk about the silk itself for a bit. How do spiders produce silk in the first place?
In their abdomens, they have silk glands. And we can talk a bit later about what those different glands are like in different kinds of spiders, because it all depends where on the evolutionary tree they are. But the glands are lined with cells. The cells produce the silk protein as a liquid. It collects in the gland. It then comes as a liquid through the duct that leads to the spinneret. There are chemical changes that happen along the way as it comes through the duct. And then as it comes through the spinneret, for reasons that have to do with protein structure, really more than just exposure to the air, the protein molecules self-assemble into a solid as they come through. It partly has to do with the molecular structure of the protein itself. It partly has to do with the way that molecular structure reacts to the passage through the duct, and it partly has to do with the pulling that the spider does, either with its legs, depending on the type of spider it is, or the tension put on the silk as the spider kind of anchors it and pulls it away. So as it comes out, it turns into solid fiber.
Now, you mentioned that there were different kinds of silk, but basically it's the same chemical combination in each kind.
Well, they're all proteins.
Right.
So in that way, they're basically same. The difference between the different silks, and for instance, orb web weavers can make, you know, more than six different silk proteins. The difference is that each one of those proteins has a different amino acid combination.
We have many, many questions, so I am going to get to one of these. From Bytor.
Could spider silk, if farmed in enough quantity, be used to make fabric like silkworm silk?
People would love to do this. There's a problem with farming spiders. There's a big problem with farming spiders. One is if they're not fed enough, they will eat each other. Let me explain. With silkworms, just for the contrast, with silkworms have been domesticated for thousands of years. And you can basically keep thousands or millions of silkworms in very big trays, essentially. And they eat leaves. So you grow and throw in these leaves in there. Then they make cocoons. They make each cocoon out of continuous silk fiber. And basically what happens is that those cocoons, the silkworm is killed in the cocoon because they don't want it to bite through that fiber. And then the cocoon is unraveled in, you know, process that's been used for thousands of years. And it comes, and you end up with a continuous thread. That's very strong. Silkworm silk is very strong. Spiders, they would love to farm spider silk for spiders for dragline silk because it's very, very strong. But as I said, the problem with spiders is each spider requires its own space. They're territorial. If you don't feed them enough, they will eat each other. In order to feed them, they're carnivorous. pretty much only carnivorous. So, you know, you'd have to come up with a lot of bugs to feed them, which would be difficult. And then they don't produce a cocoon that's easily manipulated the way that the silkworms do. The way that it's usually done is you basically pin the poor little spider on its back and induce it to start producing silk, and then you draw the silk out of the spider onto a spool. So it's very, very labor intensive. So there, you know, there's been a big push to figure out how to synthesize spider silk, but it's because proteins are so complicated, it's turning out to be a much harder problem, I think, than people originally thought it would be.
Now let's talk about the mesotheles again, because I'm still fascinated by them. But now you mentioned what they don't do is spin orb webs, and those are the webs that we traditionally think of when we think of spider webs. So which spiders do spin those kind of webs?
They're a group of spiders called the aranioids. So to give you the whole picture, there are more than 42,000 species of spider. So the mesotheles, which we talked about before, there are about 90 species of those. The kind of next biggest evolutionary group of spiders are the megalomorphs. That includes the tarantulas. Tarantulas don't spin orb webs. They're about a bit more than 3,000 species of megalomorphs. Then you get into who are called the araneomorphs, which are the spiders most of us are familiar with. There are more than 37,000 species of araneomorphs. They're all the ones who are capable of producing dragline silk. That's the silk that spiders hang from. Like tarantulas, for instance, and the other megalomorphs cannot produce dragline silk. They can't hang from their own silk. They can't hang from a single line of silk like this. So then within the araneomorphs, you get to another evolutionary phase where you start getting into the orb weavers. It's pretty clear from the evidence now that that orb webs started out as horizontal orb webs. And then what evolved were what we now know as the vertical webs. Those are the araneoid spiders. Now, there are about 11,000 araneoid species. However, not all of them spin vertical orb webs because there's been evolution beyond the orb web. So there are thousands of species of spiders who have evolved kind of beyond the orb web to create different kinds of webs.
Well, how do orb webs work? Like, how do they catch prey?
They're really amazing. In an orb web, there are multiple kinds of silk in an orb web. There's first the frame lines, which are the lines around, and the radius lines, which are the ones that radiate out from the center. That's made from dragline silk, which is also known as major ampullate silk. So that's one kind of silk. That's anchored down with attachment discs that are made from piriform silk protein. Then the spider will go around and around laying down a kind of silk known as minor ampullate silk. It puts down a temporary capture spiral. It'll then come back around and it'll recycle by eating the minor ampullate spiral and lay down a flagelliform spiral. This silk is really super stretchy. And as it's laying that down, it deposits aggregate silk protein glue along it, and that beads up into little drops. So you've got all these silks kind of meshed together. You've got this vertical orb web hanging vertically, obviously, and as a very fast flying insect flies into it, the combination of the strength of the major ampullate silk and the stretchiness of the flagelliform silk and the stickiness of the aggregate silk protein means that the insect will hit it. It will kind of trampoline back, absorbing the energy of the flying insect, and then come back to the vertical. But because it's absorbed that energy and because of the glue, you know, it holds the insect there. So that's how it works.
How do they make it so symmetrical?
I have to say that I'm not an expert in spider behavior. It's the result of certain subroutines that they have. It's interesting when you talk about spiders in terms of like, what are they aware of and what are they not aware of? It's kind of hard to tell. I don't think that you can really say that they have consciousness the way that, quite the way that humans think they have consciousness, but there are clearly complicated sensations and feedbacks and things going on so that they, you know, they actually will correct themselves as they're building the web. So there are various kind of routines and subroutines and sub-subroutines that go on as they're building these things. And to tell you the truth, I don't know if anybody yet knows exactly how they put that all together. But the interesting thing is that they're not all symmetrical. I mean, actually, most vertical orb webs are slightly unsymmetrical if you look very carefully at them.
Right.
They're actually usually a bit off center.
They're doing better than I would in that situation.
Yes. they're definitely doing better than I would do. Then there are spiders who evolved from the vertical orb weavers who, for instance, will make triangle webs, webs that are that look like a triangular section of the orb web. So the symmetry of it really, of the orb web, really appeals to us, but it's not clear sort of in a certain way how important it is.
We have a question from Lisa.
Do parent spiders teach their offspring to spin webs, or is it instinct?
It's instinct. There are spiders who are wonderful parents. The wolf spiders, for instance. The wolf spider mother will carry, you know, tens of baby wolf spiders, spiderlings, around on her back for a while until they're ready to go out on their own. But really, really tiny spiderlings will build perfect, really, really tiny orb webs.
I guess, what are the advantages of orb webs over the other kinds of webs? Does it mean that the mesotheles are lower on the evolutionary scale because they don't make orb webs?
That's exactly the question I'm very glad you asked. Okay. No, it does not. When we think about advantage, and I think that this is one of the, to go back to common misconceptions that many of us non-biologists have about evolution. And some of this goes to the language that's used, you know, as people talk about evolution. We think about sort of survival of the fittest. And you look at, you know, most of us look at an orb web and think, wow, how much more fit could you get than that? I mean, that's an obstruction. But when you think about the mesotheles hunkered down in their little burrows there, they've managed to survive multiple mass extinctions. They have survived, you know, the rise and fall of forests. They've survived the coming and going of dinosaurs. They're really doing quite well. I mean, their problem at the moment is mainly people.
Surprise.
Yeah. Well, they're, you know, we don't have them here. I mean, in a way, we can't be too judgmental. They tend to be in parts of Asia where farmers subsistence farmers are trying to expand what they're doing. So that's kind of what's threatening them. So when you think of the orb web, it evolved later than the burrows or than some of the more, what to us look like more disorganized looking webs. But it's not exactly that it's so much of an advantage over these other webs. It's that the aranoids, the vertical orb webs, moved, created a niche that didn't exist before. They started building out in more open spaces and catching faster flying insects that other spiders weren't catching. So the way that evolution works, it's not that, you know, one species is beating out another species. It's that species arise because they stumble into a new niche that, you know, has not been exploited before.
And we'll be right back to talk some more about spider silk and what it can teach us about evolution after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's a panel discussion about what happens when science intersects with politics. We're joined by Cheryl Kirschenbaum, co-author of Unscientific America, anthropologist blogger Greg Layden, and Sean Lawrence Otto, co-founder of ScienceDebate.org and author of Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America. We'll explore the tension between evidence and rhetoric and what happens when public policy ignores solid science. And Eugenie Scott, executive director of the National Center for Science Education, returns to discuss an exciting new project to defend scientific consensus. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Leslie Brunetta, freelance journalist and the co-author of Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating. So maybe before we start talking about what spiders can teach us about some of the common misconceptions about evolution, maybe you could give us an overview of natural selection and what that means in the first place.
Natural selection, it rests on three legs, basically. The first is that in every generation of a given species, the individuals vary from one another. So each one is slightly different from each other one, usually in ways that are very subtle and maybe, you know, we wouldn't be able to tell by looking at them. So, for instance, you know, if there's a group of a brood of spiderlings, we probably can't tell the difference between them, but each one of them is different from the next. What Darwin asked and Wallace asked is, okay, there's that they vary from each other. Do they each have an equal chance of surviving long enough to reproduce and to leave living offspring? And what they realized is no, they don't. So in some cases it's obvious, like maybe they're damaged in some way or whatever. Those don't survive. But there are some number of them who already have the attributes that allow them to be successful in the environment that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And they manage to reproduce and they manage to leave living offspring. The third leg is heritability, which is, okay, they then pass on their traits to their offspring. Not that necessarily every single one of their offspring will get, you know, every single one of their traits, because variation goes into the next generation as well. But the traits that have helped them to survive their environment and help them to survive long enough and help them to leave living offspring, those traits are then inherited by some number of their offspring. And so what happens is that because the way that we live and because the way that we think, we often tend to think, oh, you know, species evolve in order to adapt to their environment, or species evolve in order to survive. And it's hard to kind of make the shift, but you have to go through a mental shift. It's actually a very passive process. It doesn't involve real agency,
right,
on the part of each individual in the species.
And actually, I really appreciated that the book focused on that so much, that the helpful characteristics that would be passed along to other generations, those arose by chance.
They arise by chance.
Right.
This is another thing that often confuses people, because people often say, you know, you're ridiculous. You're telling me that the world is the way it is all just because of, you know, these just totally by chance. Well, chance is part of it. Chance is a big part of it. So, for instance, the variations arise by chance. There's a randomness. There's a certain randomness in the way. This, of course, all goes back to genes. And I hope we do a fairly good job in the book of explaining from pretty basic concepts how this
Absolutely.
Variation arises. So there's a certain randomness that in the way that variation arises. But in terms of the selection, which again sounds like agency, so that's a difficult thing, but in terms of the traits that the environment favors, that's the complete opposite of randomness. If what would be a good example?
I was thinking of a spider-centric example.
Right, exactly. I should get back spiders, exactly. So let's say you have a group of spiders who can all make dragline silk. But let's say that there are a few of them there, and the real value of dragline silk is, yes, it allows you to make these webs and everything else, but the really big thing is it allows you to escape from your enemies. It's this dragline that you can drop on out of danger. So if among this group of spiders, genetic change arises that leads to an ever so slightly stronger dragline silk protein for some of those spiders are just slightly more likely to survive their siblings and to leave more offspring than their siblings do. And that then, just by math, means that more spiders in the next generation are likely to have that slightly stronger dragline silk.
Now, spiders have gone from the water many generations ago to the land, and throughout that time they have exhibited sort of a vertical progression, correct?
Well, I just want to make it clear that it's not that spiders ever lived in the water.
Right.
Spiders' ancestors lived in the water. Spiders then first evolved on land.
Right.
And it is true that as time has gone on, there has been more movement up out from underground and up into above ground spaces. Part of that, but it's an interesting thing because you can definitely imagine that spiders might never have evolved past the mesotheles. I mean, the mesotheles, except for this expansion of agriculture that I've been talking about, or, you know, human problems, mesotheles are doing fine. You know, there are like 90 species of them. They catch their food, they reproduce. The next generation comes along year after year, or, you know, whatever reproductive cycle that they're on. So you can imagine a scenario in which spiders, just for whatever, you know, genetic reasons, they didn't happen to randomly chance into the genetic variations that allowed them eventually to make different kinds of silk. We could be having this discussion, and I mean, who knows what else would be different, because I'm sure the way insects evolved would also be different if spiders hadn't evolved. But things could have stopped there. But by moving above ground, they've essentially opened up new niches, and they've essentially moved into places where they're not in competition with older species of spiders. So, for instance, you could have one species of spider that's living underground. You could have a different species that's living, let's say, under some bark in a tree above it. And you could have another kind of spider that's living out, making an orb web out in the branches, for instance. And none of those three species of spider would be competing against each other for prey. They'd be subject to different kinds of predation. So the story of evolution is really not, it's not like Wimbledon where everyone keeps knocking themselves out until you get to the winner.
Right.
The story of evolution really is descent with modification. And so it's a story of spread. It's not a story of, you know, minimizing until we get to the winter.
And that's the thing. They're moving farther and farther away from their burrows, a lot of those species. So I'm trying to segue into ballooning, which is one of the most interesting things I've ever heard.
Yeah, ballooning. So the araneomorphs, so that's that third major group of evolutionary group of spiders, The ones who make major ampulate silk, the dragline silk that's very strong, they, as spiderlings, what most of them do is, in order probably to get away from their siblings who may eat them, is they will find a high spot. They'll get up on their sort of their tiptoes, point their abdomen up into the air, and start letting out some major ampulate silk. And a breeze will catch that. They'll let out some more silk, and essentially it becomes kind of like a hang glider. Or a balloon is, they call it ballooning, but it's a little bit more like a hang glider in a certain way. So they'll be whisked up, they'll be whisked up into the air on this silk hang glider, and then they have no control over where they go, but they end up somewhere else. And definitely, it's believed that that's one big reason for why there are so many different uraniomorph species than there are, let's say, megalomorph species, because they will end up in different places where there may be different selection pressures.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about the book Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating. My guest is the co-author, Leslie Brunetta. Now, I'm going to get to some audience questions because they have piled up. A question from John.
Besides web spinning, how else have spiders evolved through time? And how many of those changes can be directly linked to more effective silk?
Well, their body shapes have evolved very differently. I mean, if you start looking through guides to spiders, you'll see an amazing variety of body shapes, leg shapes, size, color. Their behaviors have evolved in all sorts of amazingly various ways.
How many of those evolutionary changes can be linked directly to having more effective silk? More effective than previous generations, let's say, I'm assuming.
Right. To be honest, I don't really know the answer to that. I have one possible example. There's an amazing spider called the Namibian wheel spider that has this amazing, it's evolved this amazing behavior. When the spider is under attack, what it will do is fold up its legs and turn on its side and wheel down the sand dune at unbelievable speeds. Now, the thing is that this is a spider that's gone back to living in a burrow, but it's an uraniomorph spider. It can make dragline silk. It could, except that its behaviors have evolved in a different way. It has the material where it has the silk material where it could make a web if it wanted to. But the freedom that the dragline has given it is to actually move away from webs over the course of the evolution leading up to that kind of spider. So it's a spider that's evolved very long legs, running legs, and it's a spider that, yes, it lives in a burrow, but it also has these very long running legs, and that's probably a result of being able to rely so strongly on its major ampulate silk.
We have a question from Marie Claire.
How do spinnerets relate to limbs in an evolutionary sense?
Their evolutionary roots are in limbs, and there has been some very interesting genetic research that we outline in the book. And it has to do with the fact that many arthropods have legs that have two branches. One branch is the leg and one branch is the gill. And it seems pretty clear from genetic research that the spinnerets, the roots of the evolutionary roots of the spinnerets are in that gill branch of those legs.
We have one more question from Jim Carver.
How do mites fit into the evolutionary history of spiders?
Mites are also arachnids. In terms of where they're related, I'm not sure exactly how they impinge on spider evolution. The one thing I do know is that spiders themselves have mites. There are some amazing, we tend to think in terms of evolution, in terms of predators and pray. And it's only fairly recently that, you know, people are really starting to realize, whoa, parasites are really a big driving force in evolution. We're not really tuned into this yet. But even tiny spiders have tiny, tiny mites.
I don't know what to say about that. That's actually a really disturbing thought.
Yes. Every so often you'll see some sort of scanning electron microscope images of spiders that are there in order to show something like the fang or whatever. And what you also see is a mite on the spider.
Now, you and the book talking about evolvability, and I believe you made that word up, but I like it. No, it's a real word?
It's a real word.
My spell check doesn't recognize it for reference.
Yeah, I think it's one of those technical...
But it's a lovely place to end this interview. So what is evolvability based on?
Evolvability is a concept that has to do with, again, all roots of evolution are at the genetic level. Evolution is essentially the accumulation of genetic changes. So evolvability goes to the idea that certain organisms, and in this case spiders, have genomes that tend to be kind of unstable at certain places. And in other words, and again, we explain all this in the book in a way that I hope is understandable to non-biologists, is that mistakes happen during reproduction. Mistakes in the genes that are copying mistakes are made as genes are passed from parents to offspring. And in spiders, it seems that the genes for silks are quite evolvable, meaning that they have changed very often. The mistakes that happen tend to be exactly the kind of mistakes that then lead to further mistakes. And some of these mistakes have to do with repetition of bases in the DNA, which lead to repetition in the amino acids in the silks. This repetition tends to lead to a real orderliness in the protein that, for instance, gives rise to strength or, for instance, gives rise to flexibility. So spiders seem, over their history, to have been kind of primed to evolve through their silk systems in a way that's allowed them to take advantage of many, many different environmental opportunities.
Now, are humans as evolvable as spiders are?
Wow. I'm not the right person to ask that. The one thing I do know is that I think we've only been around for maybe about 6 million years, and they've been around for close to 400 million years. So I'm not sure that we've ever been put to the test the way that spiders have been put to the test.
I think that was the most polite way of telling me that spiders are better than us.
We don't really like to get into better and worse when we're talking about evolution.
Leslie, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
We've included a link to Leslie Brunetta's book, Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, do click the links to find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show or leave a glowing review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers.
Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.